After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
You know, I think what Carol's talking about is what's really needed right now is a major culture shift around how we look at death and dying. Overall, it's like we're afraid to talk about it. It's the one thing we all share that we're all marching towards. We're all walking each other home, yet we don't talk about it.
Hey everyone, it's Raghu. I'm back with Mind Rolling. I'm back with a new friend and an old friend. Old friend being Gagan Levy, who is part of the Love, Serve, Remember Foundation, and Carol Sanford. Carol, welcome. Great to have
Thank you.
Great to have
Great
you.
Great to be here.
Gagan and Carol have known each other, and I think it would be great, Gagan, if you introduced Carol and her work, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, we don't know each other very well. We play in the same sandbox quite a bit. But I will say that Carol has been a mentor for me from afar. I am a huge fan of her books, and she's really been a guiding light for a lot of leaders and businesses looking to have more responsible businesses. I had a book called Responsible Business and a book Regenerative Business, which have both been on my coffee table. And she's also, been right at the center of a lot of the major kind of systemic change movements in various industries that I've seen, particularly in natural products. There's a group called One Step Closer that I've seen her work very closely with in helping them to kind of transform what's happening in food and natural products. And I know she does that work, you know, with everything from Fortune 500 companies to startups. So I have been very excited for this conversation. I just learned that she has a connection to Ram Dass as well. But I just know there's so much wisdom from Carol for our community on the things that she's been talking about for years, whether it's, you know, regenerative business, being a regenerative leader, living a regenerative life. And now most recently, in the face of, well, I'll let her share her story, but I'll just say the most recent work she's doing around conscious dying, I think, really touches, you know, a lot of the work that we do, that Ram Dass is doing for quite a long time, actually. In honor, I'm wearing one of my favorite Ram Dass shirts here. I've got we're all just walking each other home, shirt, which was the last book that he did where, you know, he really talked about his own dying process, his conscious dying process with Mirabai Bush. But I guess that's, I'll leave it there as an intro for Carol. Okay. I'm so excited to have to be in conversation with you too.
So Carol, can we go, it's interesting actually to me that you just talked about, because I didn't say anything, but meeting Ram Dass in Berkeley after he was on a speaking tour for that particular book around the psychedelic experience with Leary. And but let's go back to maybe your more, I always like to hear, you know, how did these formative years from teenage years into adulthood, how did that form who you became and what you have to share?
Well, it's interesting. My years would go
a little earlier in my 6 to 14 years old, I was with my Mohawk grandfather. So I have, he was part of the Iroquois Nation, and he lived, he served as an advisor to the Ag, what do you call it, Farmers Bureau in the Dust Bowl. And he transformed so many people's thinking in the Panhandle of Oklahoma about how this life works. And it was a lot of wisdom. And he took me with him when I was with him in the summer and sometimes Christmas time. And so I had a father who was not, in some people's eyes, a very good person. He'd been raised very racist, and he was a judge and a very powerful man and could act on his racism. And I was in trouble with him all the time for disagreeing. And then my grandfather called me a positive contrarian because I was contrary about everything. But I had a view of a potential in every situation. So my grandfather rescued me a bit from the very strong punishing behaviors of my father and taught me to interpret my father not as an evil man, but as an incomplete man. And I found that same concept, incompleteness in humans, including in Bram Dass's work, which I can't say I was an extensive student. I worked more with Metzner. And then Metzner led me into Free Aurobindo and the Mother.
Oh, really?
Work. Yeah, wow. Which was a part of the California Institute he helped found. I think Ram Dass was involved in that founding. Anyway, those kind of threads, well, I was very young and going through my teenage years at Berkeley and until I was about 22. One other thing at Berkeley, we had Thomas Kuhn had just published his book, The Structure of the Scientific Revolution, and he was a two-year visiting scholar. I was at Berkeley in the middle of the free speech movement, the war in Vietnam. Thomas Kuhn, everybody in the world showing up there. And Kuhn took my world and all my fundamentalist Christian beliefs, which I think freed up a lot of opportunity to see other things. And so I became a devotee of Kuhn and his challenge to our little, we signed the Ratzkiller on Telegraph Avenue. And asked him questions, and he was trying to figure out what he was going to do with this idea of paradigm shift. And somebody in our little group asked him, well, how do you get people to change paradigms? And that became a lifelong question, because Kuhn said, I wrote the book, that's your job, not to me, but to the group. But I took it personally. And Gagan, I know, it's like they heard me talk a lot about paradigm shift, and it becomes a thread, and it's an instrument for be able to see where you are creating a worldview that limits what you can see. To me, it's a self-assessing mechanism, which is more important than a religion or a gospel or something that people already have the right answers. So I think that guy can't wait to think that sum up what I talk about a lot.
Absolutely. I love your, I didn't know that backstory. And I, some of my favorite things I hear you speak about is shifting paradigms and that potentiality.
Great.
You know what, Carol, that when you mentioned Sri Aurobindo and Mother, this is probably left of what we're talking about here, but that was my introduction when I went to India. It was, I met the mother when I was
Gosh.
24.
Oh my gosh. I felt goosebumps all over me. I never met her or Sri Aurobindo or Mahatma Gandhi, who was Aurobindo's best friend. But I can imagine. Can you say a bit about what that moved in you to meet her?
Yeah. She was not well, had an autoimmune disease, probably. I don't think I was ever told. And I was there in Pondicherry, that French town. Right. She came from France. She was a French woman who got dreams and visions to go to India to meet him, Sri Aurobindo, who was a great Indian philosopher saint. And I went there because I was my girlfriend. I had an Indian girlfriend who said, come, we got to meet mother. I said, okay. I was waiting to meet Neem Karoli Baba, but Ram Dass hadn't told me he could find him at that moment. So I went, and it took quite a while till she was giving darshan, allowing people to see her because of her illness. And I went, and I was actually, and this is just awful indictment of my silly personality, but I went there and I was afraid. I knew she had lost motor function, and I was afraid to be wrapped up in fear, my own fear of death. Right? And I went, and there was a guardian at the gate, this like 6'4" tall man with a big beard, white. He looked like I went to heaven. Right. And there he was. And he let me in the room, and I went to her. And it was the proverbial thing that you read in books. Oh, God, we walked in and it was just light. And that's what happened to me. Mm. And I was not a quote unquote New Ager even back then about light and all of that. And I didn't ever see anything, but I was completely absorbed in the extraordinary presence of the Divine Mother. Mm-hmm. And I had gone, and I brought prasad, something that you do with a holy person. They suggested flowers, but I was more interested in something I like, so I brought her bananas. And I remember giving her the bananas, and she went, French, and I'm from Montreal, so I spoke French. I mean, not there's anything. Ah, très bien, banane, very good. And then she just stopped my world for about several minutes. They had to come grab me, the guy at the door, and get me out of there because it was a 5-minute interview. Funny thing is, later when I met Neem Karoli Baba, Ram Dass's guru from Be Here Now, and my guru, his, he said, where were you before you came here? In Hindi, it was translated. And I was at Swami Muktananda, this other teacher, near Mumbai. And so I'm trying to get out. I was, before I could say anything in English, he pointed, which he used to do all the time, and went, mother. So I the connection was like, holy God, right? Mm. I got a training in Divine Mother in the Sri Aurobindo Ashram.
Wow.
Neat.
Yeah.
Good
what
karma.
What a beautiful story. Great karma. I studied with a Sri Aurobindo, the mother group here in Seattle, when I first came up here, because they were meeting down the street from me, and several people who were in that group had been to Pondicherry and went annually. And there was someone, I didn't realize I'm going to think as well, of course. They would share when they came back what their experience was. And, the Sri Aurobindo never met with people again. He turned everything over to the mother.
Yeah.
But he would send messages out, and they would bring them back and read them to us. And some writings, I've read everything the mother wrote during the last years of her life. Mm. And it's very, very meaningful.
Yeah, very connected to us as social beings, not, being able to live in both worlds at the same time. Yeah. Well, maybe cut to what you've been going through and sharing that would be a good idea.
I would say I'm not going through anything. It just is.
Yes.
I mean, everyone who says, "Oh, I'm so sorry, you have ALS, I'm sorry for your pain and agony," I said, "Why are you sorry? I believe I chose this path before I was born, and now that stops everything."
Really?
And I believe that there's no reason to even suffer, or at least observe your suffering, and don't talk about it, for God's sake. Because I believe the gift that we're missing, and I know there are other gurus who speak about this. It's not like I'm some special person. I don't. Most people don't talk about it. The arenas don't talk about it. But I believe every death is a portal, and it's a portal not just for the individual who's leaving one body and potentially entering another, but for everyone who chooses to sit and practice when the energy field is created of a conscious dying being. And so my job here is not to have a peaceful death and a calm death. And something that for me is to create an energy field from every moment I can stay conscious. And that's not easy a lot of times, right? But if I can be in a meditative practice or prayer practice and show others of some of the lineages, you create an energy, like the mother did that for you when you walked in the room. She was dying, and she created a portal of energy which you could move into. And I think there's another level. There's my consciousness. There's a portal, and I've got several hundred people who are sitting with me and will as I begin to die, which I'll tell you something about in a moment. But I think the important work that I'm doing so publicly and recording it, I'm making it possible for people to be able to experience what's happening with me, is I believe we need to change people's worldview of death and dying and what its purpose is and its role in. And so I'm trying to do it so publicly, imperfectly, but to create that kind of conversation. So it's not about my peaceful death and all about me.
You know, in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, they have a prayer called Poha, Powa, right. P-O-W-A. And in it, one of the things that one repeats as part of the prayer is, "May my death be of benefit to all humanity."
Oh, amazing. Right.
Yeah.
And I have them reading Thogyal Rinpoche's Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, because it's a bit more accessible.
People
who, and it has, you know, more about the bardos, and that's one way of explaining a bardo also. And we are practicing reading together, and people designing work and practices with their own consciousness while they're in the room with me, and I'm doing everything I can to be fully present and conscious. And I, you know, what's interesting about ALS is you get to know quite a bit beforehand when you're going to die or what you're going to die of. You're going to die of being paralyzed and suffocated. Doesn't that sound exciting? Of course not. And that's what people know that. But I did a lot of reading about how various sages have died in Tibet and in India, in indigenous cultures. And what they do is when they feel their work is done, and like in my case, that would be I can't speak, I can't stay sitting up, I can't begin to create things that have meaningful dialogue, they go sit down and die. And the way they do that, they stop eating and drinking and then the life force is gone in about 2 weeks at the most, sometimes a few days. That's my plan. So I'm not going to go all the way to being paralyzed. I think there's a little too much drama in that. So I'm going to do the VSET, voluntary stop eating and drinking. And I will have with me the couple hundred people who want to be very close to that portal. And they will support my transition with their energy and mine toward theirs. That's the plan.
That's amazing, Carol. Extraordinary generosity as well.
And it's reminding me of Ram Dass talking about, he would always say his favorite days on earth were days that he would be in the presence of someone dying, when he would be next to someone's deathbed, because he knew he was going to be in the presence of truth.
I worked at the Green Gulch Hospice in San Francisco with several people, including I was with my life partner when he died, with my mother when she died, with my sister-in-law, and then a lot of people I didn't know. And I promised myself, and I failed me, but I promised to every year at least once be with someone who is leaving their body. And I did that for, 22 years, and it was profound. And I'm sorry to say I forgot. Ram Dass was right. Being in the presence of someone dying is a portal to something much greater. And it's, I do believe, I thought of that when you described being with a mother. That was
what it felt. Totally. You know, the perspective that you totally seem to have absorbed into this particular experience is very much like what happened with Ram Dass. And there's a movie about it called Fierce Grace.
Right.
And you just described it in a different way. But it was interesting because he, at the beginning, he would say his guru gave him the stroke, and you know, he would, that would be a marker in his life to be able to grow from it. But he went to India, and he was with just before he ended up in Maui for 15 years or so, early 2000s, and he talked to this another woman saint named Siddhima, who was with Neem Karoli Baba for many years. And she knew that he said, you know, Neem Karoli Baba gave me the stroke. And she said to him, no, he's not giving. Why would he be giving you a stroke? Nature took place. What he gave you was the, she didn't say it in exactly these terms, but it was what she meant. Gave you the ability to be able to have a perspective to transform the suffering. And I mean, tell me how you see that as well, and how, when you got the diagnosis, what were the events sort of in that moment?
I said, all right, I feel blessed. I get to know how I'm going to die. Most people never, ever know. It just catches you off guard. And I know kind of what the path might look like. If you want to try and be conscious, the most quick in the moment thing you can do is just observe what you're feeling and seeing and thinking, and detach yourself from it by naming and watching it. I said, I had had it for 9 years by the time I was diagnosed, but I didn't know what I had. No one did. I was traveling all over the world in wheelchairs and poles. So I said, and tomorrow you remember, I've always believed, and this is an indigenous belief from my grandfather, I've always believed that we pick how we're going to die before we're born. You can't get your ticket into a body until you pick how you're going to die.
Oh, really? Wow.
And I believe that I chose this particular, quite difficult if you don't have a right perspective way to die. Only 9,000 people a year get this.
Wow.
And I believe I picked it. I don't think I said this that day, but a few days later I said, I read about and thought about death and dying my whole life since I was a child. And I've always thought it was bizarre how people talked about it. I think I chose this path because I get a few years to be with it. And I potentially to help people think about a different way to view death and dying, and particularly its purpose, which is to give us a way to learn about portals between the worlds. And so she became, and I told her how I'm going to die. That took a few months with the V-SED. And then she became calm. And then I could work on myself. Because it's very hard. Mm. She's been my business partner for 25 years.
Your daughter?
Yeah.
Wow.
She's 50. How old is she now? 52. Mm. And so she's worked with me, but never in front of what we do, always behind the scenes. Then I could talk to her about it all the time. I could start to plan. And so I knew from within the first hours that I had finally had the answer. What in the world did I pick to die from before I was born? Because I told people to ask that question all the time to keep it awake in their mind. Because most people run away from death and dying, even like you did briefly.
Yep. Right? Yep.
So if they have I wanted them to have a practical question. And the moment they told me what my diagnosis was, a neuro, as they call it, muscular disease, I said, and I said it to the doctor, that's what I picked to die from. And she laughed. She had no idea what I was talking, but it made her so nervous. She thought somehow I had to figure out a way to trigger this. No. So I could, no. I was so fine. So that's all the kind of things that were going on around it. And I go to a lab, or I can once a month, where it's all ALS caregivers. And they're all very kind, but they have no idea how to support the spiritual path. So every time I go in, I shake them up a little about what this stage might be about and what would its purpose be in our life. So those are kind of scattered thoughts about.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a positive contrarian, even in the ALS
yeah.
circle.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. in fact, I'm having to raise money because I never expected to have such an expensive disease. I always thought I'd have a heart attack because everybody in my family did. And then, you know, it doesn't cost you anything. so when I forgot where I was going. I said, I want to focus on this, changing how we die. I don't want to figure out how to deal with money. That's like an earthly beckoning back to this world. As you know, my friend Pamela Meng has helped, so I don't have to think about it, because I want to do this work. I believe it's an incredible gift to be able to develop yourself and develop your consciousness, especially while you're leaving your body, because so much more is awake in you then.
Mm. Yeah. You know what's interesting? I pose this to you, Gauguin. So Carol grew up with a grandfather, an indigenous man, who shared this incredible wisdom that we all need to have more people sharing with us and be more receptive, more to the truth. And part of it was this knowing that it was real, that you do accept before you can come down, that you accept the reality that you know the method by which you will leave this particular body. So there was, you had connectivity, believing, of course, in this indigenous wisdom, Carol, all through your life. I had that thing happen to me with the mother, where I was faced with it and had fear. And, you know, I fortunately, because I met Neem Karoli Baba, so I had some methodology about addressing that through my life. And I always say on podcasts when I have people on and we talk about this particular subject, it's not a matter of waiting until you find out your diagnosis and then do something about it. It's like a now thing. And so I pose this to Gauguin, who's a couple of generations down from us. What has this meant to you in terms of as Don Juan says in those beautiful Castaneda books, wow. You walk around with death on your left shoulder. So you have, you know, you're not dismissing or becoming remote with the reality of that. So, yeah, talk about it, Gauguin. I don't think we ever really talked about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm coming off, so this last weekend was the last 3 Dead and Company shows. And so Grateful Dead, right?
Yes.
And I really heard Jerry's poetry this weekend. Like, I've listened to a lot of Dead in my life, but you know, that's it. That work, Grateful Dead. I mean, we can walk around being afraid of dying our whole life, or we can already know that we're all dead and be grateful. And come here together, and live without that fear. I think on my shoulder at all times. I mean, you know me well enough. It's how I live. But
the way, it's not fear on the shoulder. It's presence. That it's part of birth, life, and death is present. It's not walking around with fear on your shoulder.
Well, I've heard that. I forget where I heard that, but most fear in this life comes from actually a fear of death,
yeah,
as kind of the central.
Yeah.
But you know, I think what Carol's talking about is what's really needed right now is a major culture shift around how we look at death and dying. Overall, it's like we're afraid to talk about it. It's the one thing we all share that we're all marching towards. We're all walking each other home, yet we don't talk about it. You know, I'll never forget when Ram Dass was telling the story of being in a hospital next to a deathbed, and you know, the family's all there, and they're, and the doctor, and they're saying to the person, "Oh, you're gonna be okay. We're gonna get out of here." Yeah. And they out in the hallway, and the doctor says, you know, probably has 24 hours, 48 hours.
Yeah.
And what a disservice, you know? So we live in this culture of being that afraid of this, you know, opportunity, really. You know, this won't answer it directly, but you know this story, Raghu. And I don't think I've ever talked about it here, but Carol, so my brother, Gavin, who's my younger brother and my best friend, 2 years younger than me, passed away 5 years ago. Mm. And when he left his body, about a month later, I took a walk in the woods and I actually had a conversation with him, like I'm having a conversation with you right now. And I don't know, I mean, Ram Dass used to talk about having conversations with Maharaji after he passed. He said, "I don't know if it's my imagination or if he's really there, but who cares?" You know. And for me, it was so real. And he shared things with me that actually I had confirmed later. So it was like things that I didn't know that I was downloaded from spirit or from my brother. And I went through this moment of where in my life it went from, like, I've always had a faith of those of the bardos of the other realms, but it went from faith to a confirmation that, and it was this really, it's been this interesting, I mean, over the last 5 years, just taking that in and the knowing the truth. It's not anymore like I hope or I've got faith that there's a beyond. I've been in dialogue with a spirit from the other realm. I know it's there positively, 100%. And so that's been an interesting evolution, I guess, in my path as I think about that, Raghu. I think there's the presence, but also the comfort. Just how can I use this body, this human experience, to become a better whatever spirit that I am inhabiting this body that I invited in, that I got the ticket, you know, that I invited in this karma to get this suffering or this joy and this learning to just move along in my own evolution towards hopefully, you know, a better world, a better universe in some way. And I want to ask a question back to Carol, because I had this insight in this conversation with my brother when I came out of it. You know, most of my energy and time goes into making this world a better place. My whole business I've built is around mental health, climate action, and healing food systems. And I came out of this conversation with my brother and I said, well, if I now know there's another realm, why am I working so damn hard here to make this place better? You know? And I've had a little trouble reckoning that tension of spending the time to really impact the world here, but also but knowing that this is, you know, one of many the Russian doll that I'm, you know, that I'm in. So I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Well, I have thought about your early comment, and then we come back to that one. I've had an intriguing experience being so public on every podcast, everything I write, wherever I am telling people I'm dying and how I'm going to do it. The most disconcerting thing that keeps happening is people say, I know a doctor who can cure this, or I know a healer who can heal you. And I ended up in a very public, do you know Tyson Yonkaporta is from Santalk? He's a indigenous scholar and leader in Australia.
Yes, I did a podcast with him.
Oh, okay.
Amazing.
He calls me auntie. And he says really? That I'm the one here. And we talk once a month. And he wrote the foreword to my new book. It'll be out shortly. And it was on an email exchange where some young man was trying desperately hard to convince me not to die, not to work on dying, but work on healing. And I copied Tyson on one of these. He said, if you want a copy, I'll send it to you. It was beautiful. And we'd never done a few podcasts. But he said, you don't understand, the greatest healing is dying conscious. And you're missing that point. Quit trying to rush in and give your healing message. Healing has become a trap for us not to deal with death. So that was one thought I had. The other is, I personally think we mix up what humans work is about. We would talk about making a better world. I think humans have work to do in this process of a living system. And it's not to make a better world. It's to create consciousness that we're human beings have a capacity, if developed, and that's the problem, if developed, to create the field in which the world can heal itself. It can do what it needs. And there's an arrogance and a hubris every time we say, we're doing something, sorry, to make the world better, when that's not our job. Our job is to create the field in which each living being, each species, can do its work in a living system, and then the world will work. And by the way, it's all not real anyway, the physical thing we think we're trying to fix. So I'm sorry, I'm getting a little tired. So that was my reflection back. What do you think of that?
Beautiful. Yeah, no, it's spot on. as usual.
It makes me think of, you know, Ram Dass's main thing was about the one thing that we can do, the one thing he said I can do is change my heart so that I can resonate and radiate that and allow whatever can happen, needs to happen. Yeah. We don't want to get off this wonderful conversation without talking about this extraordinary work that you've been doing through a number of books. Shall I call it in general regenerative business practice, which includes much more than that? And is that a good way to kick that off?
I would call it consciousness at work. And that means, and I started using regenerative 47 years ago because of a man I was working with who became a partner, because I felt like it was, and it was so similar to what my grandfather had tried to describe. Now, I picked business as a target because it has lots of power. And it also had a mechanism where I could teach them to make lots of money. And they never had to trade that off. And soon it became unimportant. But every client I ever had increased their revenue 35% to 65% a year.
Really?
By being conscious. Yeah. And they all said that publicly and wrote forwards to my book. So I call it the Trojan horse. I teach them how to do a lot of great things. So generally, it's about consciousness in organizations and where people work. And the regenerative is a branch, I guess you'd call it. I'm not too much into branding.
Someone in this call is into it, though. Can you talk again about what that's meant to you in the practices that you've engaged with over, I know, many years through your
business? Well, I'll just say that I just applaud. I mean, you know, Krishna Das at the end of his kirtan talks about walking in the footsteps of, you know,
those
the great
came before
just,
us, yeah.
I'll just say that the work I do around impact businesses, walking in footsteps like Carol's, you know, who have really been trailblazers in this area. And also, I mean, I think that sometimes when in Rome, you know, if you talk about profit, you can make more profit this way. They tend to do it, right? If you talk about, I want to inject consciousness, it doesn't go so well.
I think.
But it's been interesting to watch this regenerative ride. You know, it's quite a trend now, and the word has been gotten some baggage and. You know, it's a lot of folks within the regenerative movement kind of fighting amongst themselves with toothpicks as kind of mainstream business continues to roll in various ways. But it does seem like it's getting some pickup. It's infecting, you know, purpose is infecting business in a lot of positive ways. I'm very optimistic about the direction, you know, the trajectory that folks like Carol have set for businesses, small and large, you know, to be joining this movement in various ways. And I just look at it like a continuum, whether it's the human, the leader, or the business, it's a continuum of, you know, them moving along, becoming more aware, witnessing their, you know, our actions, our consciousness around certain ways that we are in the world, whether we're a human or we're a business, and realizing that we can have more harmonious relationships with our ecosystem and our surroundings and people and the planet and so forth if we bring more consciousness, and hopefully, you know, businesses and leaders move along that continuum in some way. And I've seen Carol move many of these movements, businesses, leaders along that continuum over the years of watching her work in the world.
Hmm.
Can I be a brief positive contrarian?
Please.
I think most people have missed the major work that regeneration is about and are making it about forests and land and things. And business is the mind that you unless it shifts. And my newest book, which will be out September 7th, is about the epistemology being wrong that we're working with, and it's spreading rapidly, and I think depleting what regeneration can do. So I'll send you both a copy of the book as soon as it releases, if you'll give me an address or a Kindle that says, here's what's missing for the movement to actually work and make any difference.
Well, I'm really interested in this because I saw that you're doing some things engaging around sacred texts and divine listening. And I would love to hear more about, because it sounds like that's where you're going potentially with this new book in some way.
Actually, that is about supporting all the people who want to know how to be with me dying. Mm. There's way too much trying to take care of me. The new book is more about how we live in a world dominated by behaviorism, and that the whole idea of everything is external, and the experts, like I'm called an expert, and it's the biggest insult you can give me. It means I'm not doing my work, because I'm sorry, but I don't even believe in gurus, because I believe I'm a little like Krishnamurti. But I think that the whole idea we've got around regenerative experts and so forth is an example of what John Watson did when he created behaviorism, which is take people's minds away from them and supplant it with absorbing ideas, best practices, etc. And the book is subtitle, well, the title is No More Gold Stars. And the subtitle is Regenerating Capacity to Think for Ourselves, because we don't do that anymore. And the regenerative movement, I think, is filled with people with their toothpicks, as you say, competing to be the best expert rather than teaching people to think for themselves and examine what's going on. And I think the inability of us to examine ideas and become our own researcher, our own experimenter, is really important if we actually want to learn to see what a living system is like and how it works, how society works. So that's, I have my, what you call public facing work and my sacred work. Mm. And they're in kind of different domains. Most of the people who are members know about the spiritual side, but my public work is all transliterations of that, trying to take everything Ram Dass said, the mother, Gurdjieff, other saints around the world. There's threads that run through all of it, and we don't know how to see it. And so everybody has their own teacher, their own path, but mostly regeneration is not starting from wisdom like that. It's starting from pop psychology based on behaviorism. Mm.
Well, Buddha did say you should be your own researcher. So
yes,
you're right, exactly. In line.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right? You know what I love, Carol, from just, you know, stuff that I've read and noticed? There's this one, I just have to hear about this before we leave. Disrupt your current certainties. Yeah. I love that. And that's so much, we are so lost in thinking we know, and we are so committed to it. How do we disrupt?
All right. So one of the things I believe, which I don't know is in any spiritual tradition, but it's probably because it's another form, is the idea of everything alive has an essence.
As a what? I'm sorry. Everything that's alive?
Has an essence.
Essence.
Yes, you're right. Thank you. Sorry, my tongue doesn't work so well. We can really see and understand that, like, you were born with part of what you got as you came in with an essence, which was really who you are, what your being is. and your being is more important than any of your doing, as you well know. And so one of the things I do a lot with my clients is help them learn their essence work. And mine, as my grandfather said, is to disrupt certainty. The minute somebody says something, I'm very good at hearing what paradigm they're speaking from, and they don't know it.
Yeah.
I'm going to go back to Gagan and work on his impact. That's a Newtonian idea, not a quantum idea. I can hear it immediately. And so I go to work from the minute he says something, I'm disrupting when he currently thinks is right, when he's not, because I want him to agree with me. I want him to learn how to get unstuck. And more importantly, don't know how to see the essence in everything. I have a story in the regenerative business about a mother and daughter, Nancy and Jane. And Nancy had just come out of prison and gotten her daughter back at 13 years old. And she was cutting herself, doing terrible things. Her mother was trying to save, and I ran a program for ex-prisoners with children. This without Alcatraz. What she had been trying to do was teach her to be a good girl. It was constantly affirming when she had the right behavior. And when she came out, she also tried doing things mothers should do with daughters, cooking, whatever it was she thought. And she came to me in this class at the back of the room and said, well, Jane is not getting better, and I'm doing all these things. And I said, well, what is it Jane is about? What does she get excited about? What's she trying to do in the world? She spends too much time in theater or doing all this theater stuff. I said, well, what's that look like? Well, she writes plays and goes and produces them with her friends. I said, what are the plays about? And she said, well, all she's upset about. I said, well, how did they end? She said, well, she figured things out and told her friend. I said, I built her a theater. and I built a program on, because that's her essence. She helps people see and helps herself see by exploring through storytelling. Yeah. And she thought that was kind of useless, but it's her essence. And about 20 years later in Palo Alto, California, I went into a kids' play. And there was Jane teaching all these kids in a community center how to work on their stuff through writing plays, creating theater, building costume, and remaking their lives.
Wow.
That's a disrupting certainty for Nancy, and she got it. Mm. And she supported her daughter's essence.
Oh, that's beautiful. I love that.
Yeah.
Oh, so great. Great to meet you, Carol. Really.
It's so great to meet you, Rego. I'm just delighted.
And thanks, Gagan, for joining us. I don't know if you Absolutely. Have any last thoughts.
Well, just that I know that, I mean, Carol, what you shared about how this next steps of the journey and this generous way that you're walking that path with these folks around you and creating that portal. And I just think maybe there's folks from the network who might want to support, as I think you put it, that, you know, there's us humans have to deal with this money thing sometimes. So the more that this community could do, to help with that, obviously it frees you up to do this incredible work that'll be so beneficial for the rest of us. So I just maybe, would put out there to the community. I don't know if they can go to your website, if there's something on the website or something that we could
put out on the network. Again, we'll have a direct link in the show notes that we'll get from Pamela, I guess. And
yeah.
And people will be able to directly, obviously, link to Carol's website to get all this wonderful wisdom available. to be able to get to it. And, you know, there's blogs. It's rich. Podcasts. Yeah. Carol's got a lot of material, so plenty to choose from. So we'll have that as well. And, yeah, again, we thank you. And sharing your journey and doing what you're doing, it does remind me exactly of Ram Dass and what he did.
Well, that would be lovely, because the spirit world he left behind for all of us is such a gift. So any part that I can share in my own learning, I'm happy to be a part of your community as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So everybody, this is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and take advantage of all the wonderful presenters and podcasters that we have available, from Ram Dass to Alan Watts to Jack Kornfield and Krishna Dass. So we look forward to seeing you again next week. And again, thank you very much. Again, Carol.